This is Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. We hope you'll stay tuned. And I am very, very pleased to have with us Patricia Davis, who is president of the Washington Council on International Trade and also a member of the Board of Governors for the National Center for Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, also known as APEC. Patricia Davis, thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we appreciate that you were able to be with us. So you are up in Seattle getting ready for the World Trade Organization's ministerial meeting, which will be happening in about two weeks, or something like that.
Yes, the first, right after Thanksgiving.
You bet, and it's, I'm sure, very, very busy and going to get even busier.
We are very busy.
Can you talk a little bit about the Washington Council on International Trade? Because as I understand it, the council and yourself personally were very much instrumental in bringing the WTO meeting to the United States and Seattle, Washington.
Yes, our council is a nonprofit, nonpartisan association that is supported by private sector interests who are in the business of trade, and that includes educational institutions as well. But we have worked since 1973, actually, to promote the understanding of the importance of trade and to support public policies that are favorable to expanded trade.
Can you talk, if you will, about some of the logistics that it took to bring the WTO meeting to Seattle?
It took about 5 months. We submitted a proposal from here, and there were 40 other cities that did the same. And so the United States Trade Representative's Office, which is a part of the White House, went through a procedure of winnowing those down to 20, and then 12, and then 6, and then 2. And we had site visits from Geneva, from the WTO people, and from USTR twice. And then finally, in January, they decided on Seattle as the site.
What has it taken for Seattle and for the Washington Council on International Trade to get ready for this meeting? I mean, not only do we have the issue of the meeting itself and all of the people who will be coming to that, but of course we also have some other issues of people who will be coming to Seattle, and we'll talk about them in a little while. But what is it taking to get ready for all of this on behalf of the Council and the City of Seattle?
Well, first of all, we have to raise enough funds to pull it off. That's about $9.2 million, which we're still working on from companies around the country and also Europe and Japan. So we're doing a very intensive fundraising. The way we do it in America is the president says, you all come, and then turns to the private sector and says, now you all pay, because our taxpayers don't want to pay for international meetings, I guess. We also have, of course, the transportation and logistics a function that's very critical for bringing people in and treating the dignitaries appropriately, and also housing them. We have secured 5,000 hotel rooms. Actually, 7,500. We had to add 2,500 more. We have a committee, of course, that's going to work with the media, because nobody's more important than the press, after all.
Well, we like to hear that.
Well, it's how it's reported out that really counts in terms of the achievements here. We have a big hospitality effort underway with the grand reception at the beginning and then a small one at the end, and a minister's dinner, which is particularly for the dignitaries as they come in. And we have had a long education and outreach, a series of programs that help people understand what the WTO is, why it's important, and what it does, because, of course, we can't attend the actual negotiations ourselves. The public doesn't. It will be held in the convention center. Of course, there's a massive amount of facilities and equipment that have to be built into the convention center to make this happen. You can imagine the telecommunications that are needed for everybody, 134 countries, plus 2,500 press. And so that's an enormous effort as well. And we have a huge volunteer pool who are helping us out. We're doing this almost entirely by volunteers, not paid professionals.
We're talking with Patricia Davis, president of the Washington Council on International Trade. We're talking about the upcoming World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle, and right now what it took to pull off all of that. Patricia Davis, let me ask you, when you're talking about dignitaries coming to Seattle for the WTO meeting, I mean, who are we actually talking about? I don't necessarily mean names, though if we know some names, that would be great. But who are we actually talking about? Who are the people who are actually coming to participate in this meeting?
They are trade ministers from the 134 member countries. They're not the leaders, say, like presidents. Unless President Clinton asks them to come, they may come, but generally, this is a meeting of trade ministers and their delegations. President Clinton is expected to come and kick it off, however, of course, because he invited them here in the first place. But other than that, we don't know of any leaders from countries. There's some rumor that Fidel Castro might come.
I've heard that, too.
Yeah, Castro has been a member. Cuba has been a member since the beginning, which surprises some people.
Cuba is a member of who?
Of the WTO.
Oh, really? Well, that's a really interesting thing. I mean, I didn't know that, and
most of us don't.
Well, what's really interesting? I mean, how can Cuba be a member of the WTO at the same time that the United States has this massive embargo going against Cuba? Has that been challenged by the WTO?
No, it hasn't, and it is a unilateral kind of thing. Cuba does trade with other nations, and so it isn't as if they're not able to engage elsewhere in terms of their need to trade and other countries' willingness to trade with them. It's a unilateral situation that the United States has imposed, and I guess you could ask, after 40 years of embargoing Fidel Castro, have we gotten rid of him? And the answer is no. So the question is, do sanctions work?
Well, it seems to me that on the one hand, and certainly we're going to talk about international trade and so-called free trade and all of that, but it seems to me that on some level, at least as I understand what the World Trade Organization is about and what they are attempting to facilitate, that, I mean, an embargo like that would be anathema to the very reason that the WTO exists. I mean, it seems that way to me.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense to you?
It does, and Cuba was there from the beginning, and so because we're sanctioning them, there isn't a case, I guess, that has been brought or would be brought for us to stop that. There's a lot of sentiment in our country to stop it because it isn't working
right, for
the purpose that it was first initiated. So, and it is surprising for those who are subscribe to the Marxist philosophy that he would be sitting down with the so-called corporate fat cat world and sit down and do trade deals that would, supposedly help his people.
Now, it's very interesting because I had absolutely no idea that Cuba was a member of the World Trade Organization. That really surprised me.
Well, the best thing to get rid of dictators and people that we don't particularly favor is to open the doors and start engaging the people, get them to so that they're prosperous enough so that they take care of it from their own grassroots citizenry.
We're talking with Patricia Davis, who is a member of the Board of Governors for the National Center for Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation and the Washington Council on International Trade. Patricia Davis, let me ask you, because I'm not sure of the particulars, but has an agreement already been made and the decision already been made that China is now part of the World Trade Organization?
There has been a breakthrough with the United States and China, which was the sticking point. And what China has to do now is do the same kind of agreement with, I think there are two more outstanding countries that were on their committee to help them accede to the WTO, help them develop the reforms and all that needed to be made, and those are Canada and the EU. So they need to sign off the same way they just did with us, which is an enormous breakthrough, and everybody here is very pleased, and many people in the United States. Sign those agreements with those two countries. Go back and put their house in order and begin to do some some housekeeping things. And then it has to go to the General Assembly, the General Council, which I guess takes a couple of months. And so I don't think that the accession will take place in Seattle, which is disappointing, but the breakthrough has been made, and everybody is very happy that that has happened.
It would seem to me that, well, let me ask you this. Perhaps maybe this is a real opportunity to segue into talking about the World Trade Organization, and as I was sent some documentation from your organization to talk about what the myths and the realities mm-hmm. of the WTO are. I mean, on the one hand, we hear that China is this massive abuser of human rights, whether it be regarding issues of Tibet, whether it be regarding issues of other people within China, the alleged use of slave labor, things like that. I mean, how, to what degree does human rights play in international trade agreements and, you know, the whole process of the WTO? I mean, on the, you know, it seems if these people are as bad as some people would want us to believe, I mean, why are we doing business with them? Why would we even want to do business with them?
Well, I think history shows that once you open up a country, the winds of democratic change flow in with the cultural and commercial exchanges that begin to take place. And that's what's happened in China. They are turning themselves into a capitalist economy. They're doing it as slowly as they can so that they don't disrupt too many people, because people are thrown out of work when bankrupt enterprises are no longer sustained by the government. But it's quite amazing that what China gave on this agreement was so dramatic that even some of the harshest critics of China's human rights programs, Human Rights Watch is one, and the International Campaign for Tibet, agree that the potential for reform was much greater if China is open and part of the 134-member world group that monitors how they do trade, how fair, how equitable, how non-discriminatory, and how transparent their system is. This will bring legal change, legal reform. It will bring accounting principles that we understand that are good and straightforward. It will open their economy and therefore their society and therefore people's understanding of their rights much better than if we slam the door on the hope of those people who want reform in China.
You brought up the term democratic, and certainly one of the harshest sort of global criticisms, if you will, of the WTO and the international free trade that it supports and or regulates, is that many, many people are criticizing the WTO, saying that, look, I mean, this is a bunch of people at the very top of the global economic heap who are making rules and agreements that benefit them in an undemocratic process, and making those rules at the expense of the billions of people who are left over. And I'm hearing you say, and I know the Washington Council on International Trade says, this isn't true.
Well, it's not, and I really don't think there are a lot of people saying that. There are some people, and they've been
they're very vocal, absolutely.
Yeah. But the truth of the matter is that is really an exaggerated picture of what the World Trade Organization is. It's definitely a member organization. It doesn't do anything that its members don't tell them to do. It does do what its members ask, and that is to negotiate out trade problems. And there are lots of them around the world, and there's a lot of inequity. And they sit at the table and duke it out there instead of going to war, which is what used to happen. But it is a very democratic institution. It is represented by trade ministers from each of the countries, and those countries choose those ministers. 80% of them are democratically done. Some countries aren't that far yet, but they nevertheless represent their countries. And the way they go about their procedure is even more democratic than we have here in this country, where you can have a vote of 51-49 and win the day. There, it's a consensus-based operation whereby everyone has to agree or nobody can disagree before the new rules-based whatever procedures they've negotiated out are accepted. So it's cumbersome, but every single country has a voice, and so it's completely contrary to what some of the protesters are saying. It is very democratic, represents everybody, and you can have a voice. Now, if you want to get something on the agenda there, you have to go to your country and get your country's representative and government to take that to the WTO table. So it's a two-step process.
Right, and I guess on some level, to play devil's advocate, I think some of the people who are the most vocal critics of the World Trade Organization would say that the governmental structures that are operating in many of the countries that are members of the WTO are already the allies of the people who benefit or who seem to benefit or who might benefit, which are very, very rich financial investors, big multinational transglobal corporations. And, you know, that if I or you might be able to go talk to them. But if I had an issue that I wanted to talk to them about, I wouldn't have that opportunity because those doors are closed before I could even get there. I mean, that's what people say.
You know, if it's in this country and the people are saying it here, they can go to their representative, their congressman, to the USTR, and they are doing that, by the way, and the USTR is paying a lot of attention to these complaints and saying maybe we ought to consider these things, and they're open, their doors are open to those problems. Now, in countries where the darn is open as ours, where we can have our voices heard, it may be that there are groups that are profiting more than others from trade. But what happens is that once you open up a country to more expanded trade, open its doors, more people get jobs, more people become a little more secure, they begin to demand their political rights, better working conditions, a better environment for themselves and their families. So once you get people to a point where they don't have to worry about starving to death, they will begin to change what those not-so-representative governments are doing. Imposing it from the top does not work. We haven't toppled Castro. We haven't gotten rid of the dictator in North Korea. We aren't getting rid of Saddam Hussein. They just punish their own people with sanctions. But we do have a couple of countries that this has worked, what I just described has worked in. That's Korea and Taiwan. Their people are demanding better environmental conditions, better wages. They have right to organize as unions if they choose. We also have the middle ground then of China, which is beginning to open, and people are demanding more rights. They're demanding more religious freedom. And those, because they feel more stable, they have a job, they can support their family. That's just the way the world works.
This is Full Logic Reverse. We'll be back in just a few moments. What about the criticism that many people try to level at the WTO, saying that while on the one hand we do see these movements for human rights, political rights, religious freedom happening in countries, as you so stated, but what then happens because of the liberalization of the movement of capital and jobs, that when it gets to the point that those people are asking too much and that is decided within private enterprise, that these companies just simply pick up their investments and move somewhere else. And there's nothing to stop them from doing that, and they just revolve around in a circle.
Well, there's nothing to stop them from moving around from country to country, no. But what happens is that as a country becomes more stable, if it is a member of the WTO, it has to adhere to certain rules. It's a rules-based structure that everybody has agreed to. If it does that, then its economy is more open. There's more likelihood for investment that will stay there if the economy is stable than if it's not. So if the country is outside the WTO, and there are 30 countries that are trying to get in, by the way, and China with 1.2 billion has wanted to get in, people have wanted to get in for 13 years,
right,
must say something about it, that the rules-based structure helps stabilize things so that those investments will come there and stay because things are predictable, they know they can get their return. They know they won't be confiscated, or it won't be a phony securities kind of thing, or whatever that has been going on in the past. That's the advantage, is that there are predictable rules, so what you described won't begin to continue to happen.
We're talking with Patricia Davis, president of the Washington Council on International Trade. Patricia Davis, let me ask you this. One of the major criticisms that is leveled at the WTO and its process is that it is completely unconcerned, if you will, about the environment, or perhaps more accurately, that financial profit has been elevated to the most important value, and if that means the environment must be damaged in order to maximize profit, then so be it. And I'm hearing the Washington International Council on Trade say also that that is not the case either.
Well, what the World Bank and many, many people now say about the environment is that the environment is degraded faster in countries where there is abject poverty than anywhere else, because poor people will eat their environment. They have to. They have to cut down their trees. They have to use their water in any way they can get it. The air quality, they have no means to improve. There are $1.3 billion people who live on a dollar a day, which is severe poverty. And until they're able to stabilize themselves and feed their family, they will trash their environment, not because they want to, but because they have to survive. So if you want to lift a country up and you want to deal with the poor and help them, you get investment in there, and the investment environment is stabilized by agreements that, like the ones that are agreed to at the World Trade Organization, lift them up out of their poverty, help them get a job, and then they start demanding better air, better environment. They save their forests and their land. That is the way the world has been working. And most American companies now that invest abroad take their best practices where they go and establish the same kinds of factories there. There are, of course, violations. We read about them. We know about them. There is child labor still in this world because families have to survive, and so they let their children work. Those things need to be corrected. But stopping trade is the worst thing you can do to the poor people of the world. It slams the door of hope on them, and they can't pull themselves up as we did in our country. We had child labor not so long ago. Our rivers were burning up in the Midwest in the 60s, catching on fire. We corrected that because we were prosperous enough to demand that we establish laws that this couldn't happen anymore. So history proves that that poverty is the worst thing, and you can keep your environment healthy if you have enough wherewithal to do it.
Do we have any examples where the WTO has stepped in to defend environmental laws as they're passed in countries? I guess it's one thing for, it sounds great. Has the World Trade Organization actually taken any action in saying, we're going to uphold high environmental standards in, say, this country or a specific law that was challenged?
They don't make judgments on countries' environmental laws. I mean, they like the fact that there are some really stringent laws, say, in the United States. That's good. I mean, they have an Article 20 which says that endangered species and environment should be protected. The judgment that the WTO dispute panels make is on whether those laws are used to discriminate. And if you're talking about the case with the Clean Air Act, which has been distorted by the protesters, the fact of the matter is the WTO found against the United States because it allowed our domestic suppliers to have a less clean gasoline, which was our clean air standard, than they were demanding of the Venezuelans and Brazilians who were importing. In other words, we demanded a higher standard than our Clean Air Act, and we let our own suppliers have a lower standard. The WTO said, your standard is fine, but if you want to raise your standard, that's fine too. You just can't use it to discriminate.
So in other words, what I'm hearing is, as a contrary to what many people are saying regarding the WTO, is that in this case, it really was the environmental protection law regarding clean air was actually being used as somewhat of a trade barrier, if you will, under the guise of environmental protection.
No, the clean air standard wasn't used as a barrier. What the regulation said was that an importer like Venezuela or Brazil had to have a higher standard than our clean air standard.
Right, and then my point being, of course, is if they had to have a higher standard, that they couldn't meet, then in essence we were giving advantage to our domestic suppliers.
Exactly.
Because they didn't have to meet the same standard.
Right.
That's what I'm hearing you say.
Right, our domestic suppliers had to meet our clean air standard. The Venezuelans and Brazilians product met our clean air standard, and then they had to meet another standard.
Okay,
I understand. That's what the WTO said you can't do. If you want to raise your clean air standard to that higher standard that we're demanding of Venezuela and Brazil, fine. The WTO would like to see, and members of the WTO would like to see cleaner air and water, especially in the industrial countries, which do a lot of the pollution. But that case has been so distorted by the protesters, and and erroneously reported. It's really disappointing.
We're speaking with Patricia Davis, president of the Washington Council on International Trade. Patricia Davis, we just have a few moments left due to some other segments that we're doing. And what I wanted to ask you was, is that you know the criticisms, and I've heard the criticisms, and many people have heard the criticisms of the World Trade Organization and all that it allegedly represents. Mm-hmm. We know that there are going to be thousands of people coming to Seattle to protest what will be happening, or what at least what they think will be happening inside the convention center. What do you say to those people that will help them to feel that maybe things aren't quite as bleak and nefarious as many people have been led to believe?
Well, I guess the shortcut would be to go to the website. We have one, WTOseattle.org, but the WTO itself has one, which is WTO.org, and that's in Geneva. And you can read about it there. You don't have to take my word for it or anybody else's. And I would hope that people would want to find out what's really going on, what the truth is, and ask themselves, would the world be better if we didn't have a place to sit down and discuss our problems? Should we go back to war to solve them? Or would we reinvent another kind of organization worldwide that would help us solve then these problems? And there are many very intractable problems. I mean, agriculture, think of every crop and every country trying to protect its agricultural products. It's a very difficult and complex circumstance. But in the end, more people are helped. The poor of the world particularly have a chance. And there's more world of opportunity for people in the industrialized countries take advantage of innovation and opportunity. So I just would hope that people would take the time to really find out something before they go dancing around the streets in their turtle costumes.
Well, I don't know that they're all going to be going out dancing in their turtle costumes. There
no,
may be some people doing that. But, I mean, I think it's a little unfair to sort of dismiss the protest is simply just being people in turtle costumes. I mean, there are a number of, I think, fairly well-respected intellectuals and authors and scientists who have voiced opposition as well.
Well, there are different sorts of people. I mean, labor wants to get its goals on the agenda. They don't want to stop the WTO. The mainstream environmentalists want to get environmental considerations on the agenda, and they're trying to work with the situation to get their agenda moved forward. There's a core group of people, though, that are anti-trade, anti-globalization, anti-capitalist, who really want to stop everything. They want to stop the world and get off, I guess. I don't know. They want to throw up the walls of isolationism and just halt this world that is moving too fast, maybe. And the question is, will that cure the ills that the world we all see out there? Or will it help it? And I guess our answer is it won't help to slam the door and to stop everything.
On that note, we'll have to end. Patricia Davis, President of the Washington Council on International Trade, thank you for joining us from Seattle to talk about the upcoming meeting of the World Trade Organization. Hopefully we'll have an opportunity to meet up there and we can talk a little bit more about this. And
sure.
Perhaps I'll see you in Seattle.
Thank you very much.
Thank
I look forward
you.
To it.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of the program today. I'm your host, Mike Thornton, and it's been my pleasure to be part of the team bringing you Full Logic Reverse. If you'd like more information about FLR, you can contact us via email, flr@jps.net, or by telephone, 530-271-0804. We invite you to join us next time for another edition of Full Logic Reverse.